Good evening.
I would like to start, I'm very nervous mostly about condensing all this material that I have and all these thoughts that I have and ideas that I have into such a brief amount of time, and it already feels, I can feel the pain already of not being able to fully give these rabbinic personalities their due. But I do want to preface first by saying a word about the imagery of the portrait gallery that I have recently been using for this class. And I insisted, as when we publicized, I insisted that we work somehow the idea of the portrait gallery into the title, Highlights of the Talmudic Portrait Gallery. Actually, this image came to me now, it's about 2 years ago. I spent about 6 weeks in London. I am a huge museum lover, and London was obviously heaven. And one of the museums and galleries that I found myself returning to a number of times was the National Portrait Gallery. And as I was wandering through the galleries and really thinking about why did I find myself returning time and again to the gallery, what I discovered, or what I articulated finally to myself, was that there was at this one and the same time three perspectives from which I was continuously looking at or wandering through the galleries, looking for and looking at. One was the actual individuals that were hanging on the walls, the portraits of whom were hanging on the walls, and I was learning a lot about history and about names that I might have been familiar with or totally unfamiliar with, and I was trying to just fill in gaps in my knowledge about who people were and what their achievements had been and who did what in the area of sciences and who did what in the area of history, etc., etc. So that was one angle from which I was very interested in these galleries, knowing more about the history of Britain and those British subjects that were hanging, whose portraits were hanging up. So that was one aspect, with the individuals themselves. The second angle from which I found thinking about were, of course, the way the artists portrayed each individual in any given portrait, right? How was the artist attempting to convey information, to convey facts, to convey... all the information that he was trying to convey about the individual, right? What were the artistic tools that he was using? Whether it was color or shade or texture or props or background or a posture or certain right, certain objects or certain color, right? Shading and coloring and lighting and everything that an artist has at his disposal. And I was very interested in trying to determine how any given artist was attempting to paint a portrait and convey information through that portrait. So that was the second angle, was to be interested in the artistry of the portrait. And the third angle, which took me longer maybe to be sensitive to, but once I was, I found it maybe possibly to be the most interesting, was the curating of the museum, of the gallery itself. In other words, whose portrait is chosen to hang on the wall of any given gallery? Whose portrait is presented and with whom, alongside whom, right? Who's collected in one gallery alongside other individuals, whose portrait is not even there, and what size portrait, right? Who gets a whole wall? Who gets a little corner tucked away a little bit, you know, in the dark? Who gets a spotlight on his portrait? So those were, that was yet a third angle from which I found myself looking through the galleries and understanding more about the National Portrait Gallery, whoever it was that put this National Portrait, what were they trying to say about themselves, about their culture, about who they were. And then when I came back to teaching my Talmudic Personalities class, I actually discovered or realized that I was continuously, I was doing the same thing with rabbinic texts. I was both trying to, and what we will try to do in the course of this series, is look at individuals while trying to understand something about their stories, who they were, what their achievements were, what their successes were, what potentially, possibly, maybe also their tragedies were, their failures were, if they had them as well. So we'll try and put together little biographies of specific characters, specific individuals, but we will also be spending time looking at the artistry of the portrait painting. How do rabbinic texts portray an individual? How do we, with just very slight touches of the brush, right? How do we color in? How do we shade in? How do we offer you a prop or a background or a backdrop or an idea to a context in which to perceive, in which that character is portrayed. And then, of course, as always, there's the curating, right? Whose portrait are we able to even access? What size portrait? Who's spotlighted and who's maybe perhaps marginalized? And whose portrait maybe perhaps is not even on the walls? So we're going to be looking, as we read these texts, at all three perspectives. Sometimes it's not always going to be, or often, it will not be always easy to distinguish between the three, right? Are we actually looking at the person himself? Are we discovering something about the person? Are we discovering something about the artist who's telling his story? Or are we discovering something about the culture that is curating all of this and is choosing whose stories to tell and in what way? So that's a broad introduction. With no further ado, I would like to begin, because our first personality is a very striking and an engaging personality that will require our thinking and our talking and our discussion. Here we are. Okay, so I'd like to introduce our first personality, the first character that we will spend tonight with. I'm going to actually have him introduced to you, not by me, but by somebody who knew him much better than I do, and that is his teacher. And he will be introduced to us by his teacher, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And our first taste of who this man might be will be accessed through the following text. We're reading a Mishnah from Pirkei Avot, from the Chapters of the Fathers, where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is presented. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai would certainly have deserved a class of his own, right? If this wasn't just a six-part series, but a 15-part series, we certainly would have given Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai a spot. He is maybe perhaps the rabbinic figure that is most associated with anyone?
Yavneh,
okay, or the transition from Jerusalem to Yavneh, because he is the rabbinic personality that is most associated with the destruction of the temple, right? His very dramatic departure from the siege Jerusalem, etc., etc. So we're joining the story here with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai at a very critical moment in Jewish history, and we are now going to be introduced, or Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is going to introduce us to some of his students. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai received the tradition, Pirkei Avot tells us, the Chapter of Fathers tells us. He himself received the tradition, the oral tradition, the oral Torah. He received it from Hillel and Shammai. This, by the way, is interesting because Hillel and Shammai, in the texts themselves, come across as being very different, right? As we have Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who is a student of both Hillel and Shammai. That's very revealing. And in a moment, we'll see, maybe perhaps that will also explain why Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai himself can also be the teacher of very different individuals that we will soon come to know. He would say, just in passing, again, as I said before, we're not spending too much time directly on Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, but he would say, this is what the saying, the maxim that Pirkei Avot ascribes to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, this characterized him maybe perhaps more than anything else. He used to say the following: if you have learned much Torah, do not take credit for yourself. It is for this that you have been created. Right? That's an interesting maxim for someone to be identified with. I sometimes wonder, who is this man who is most identified with this saying? This is his ethos, right? You are here on the face of the earth to study Torah. If you've studied much Torah, do not take credit. Don't think highly of yourself. That is precisely what you were created for. I sometimes wonder what it must have been like to study Torah from a man that this is his ultimate insight into the world. In any case, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Mishnah continues to tell us, had five disciples. I will for a moment assume that he probably had more than five disciples, but he had five outstanding disciples that are being recorded here as being the next generation to have tradition transmitted to them and then through them to the generations to come. Five disciples are mentioned in his context: Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, Rabbi Yoshua ben Hanania, Rabbi Yossi the Kohen, Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel, and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Five students. You might recognize the last of which is the topic for, it will be the topic for tonight, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, the first amongst these five, is next week's personality. Okay, so we're going to be introduced now into basically our first two personalities, the one we'll be speaking about tonight and the one we'll be speaking about next week. The Mishnah then continues and tells us that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai would recount their praises. He would describe them and praise them, his five students, thus. And we're going to hear a very, very concise description of each one of his students as formulated and articulated by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. If you'll allow me a parenthetical remark for a minute, I also teach high school. And what's about to happen now, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gives a description, a very concise description, I have this very strong sense of identification with, because as everyone who's ever taught school here knows, that there, or been to school, I guess, which is everybody, that there comes a time in the rhythm of the school year when a teacher is expected to give an assessment and to write an evaluation. And then you're usually given about a one-line spot, right, where you have to say something significant in about 15 words and no more, something of significance about each student, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is about to attempt that. And I have a huge amount of respect for anyone who's successful. Oftentimes, when I'm called upon to write an assessment, I find that I really have nothing very significant to say. And if I do, can I get it into a 15-word? Most often not. And here, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is about to do that. And here's what he does. Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, he tells us, is a plastered cistern that loses not a drop. He is, I'm going to use the original for a minute, he is a bor sud, a plastered water cistern that never, eino me'abed tipa, it never loses a drop. Rabbi Yoshua ben Hanania, fortunate is she who gave birth to him. That's what's written on his report card. It doesn't.
It doesn't. Yes, it absolutely does.
Well,
that his mother really gets nachas.
Okay.
Because he is so bright.
Okay, I know mothers who get nachas from their kids, even if they're maybe not objectively so great. But okay, whatever. For a minute, let's hold on. Rabbi Yossi HaKohen, a chassid. He's a pious one. Okay, a chassid. Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel, yerechet, a fearer of sin. Rabbi Lazar ben Arach is an ever-increasing, overflowing wellspring, a ma'ayan mitgaber. Now, initially, intuitively, we could detect that there are different types of descriptions going on here, both in terms of content as well as in terms of form. Some of the descriptions seem to be speaking about or more focused on anyone?
Their
character, okay? A fear of sin, pious. Whereas others seem to maybe focused more on their
learning
style. What kinds of students are they? What kind of scholars are there? And they definitely do seem to be, and maybe some are ambiguous that we're not even quite sure exactly what they're describing. But another difference, but which we can be absolutely confident, is also stylistically and literarily, it's clear that there are two individuals for whom Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai turns to the use of metaphor. There are two that are described with a metaphor, and there are three that are described, maybe not necessarily absolutely clear, but using direct language, okay? The two that are described with metaphor, probably, again, not coincidentally, are the first and the last, whose names even echo each other, Elazar and Eliezer. The first and the last, we use metaphor. When I ask myself, why turn to metaphor? Right? And what's the effect of the fact that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai uses specifically a metaphor for these two students and not for the others? What occurs to me, at least, is that what does a metaphor do? The fact that he used a metaphor, what does that do to me as a reader? What does it require me to do?
To decipher.
And to decipher means to pause, to stop for a moment. I require to stop for a moment and think a little bit more about the model of the water cistern that never loses a drop. What would that mean? What does that mean when transferred to a person, to a scholar, to a student? And what, on the other hand, does it mean to be an overflowing water fountain that ever increasing strength, right? So the use of metaphor, now of course we all notice that the metaphors are also linked to Well, they're opposites, but they're also linked. Why are they linked?
Water.
They're both water metaphors, okay? So I think all of that suggests that we need to pause for a minute and think a little bit more about these two models and also consider them one in reference to the other. They almost demand that. They almost require that, right? So not coincidentally, and that is precisely the reason that this course is going to be, class is going to begin with Rabbi Lazar ben Arach and Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkinus. I'm taking my cues from their teacher, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He's enticing me. He's tempting me. I nearly want to say he's seducing me to spend more time with Rabbi Lazar ben Arach and Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkinus and to think a little bit more about who are these men that we use, that he uses metaphor to describe. If I wasn't already convinced, and I personally am, but if I needed more convincing, I would continue the Mishnah, just the second part of the Mishnah, or the last part of the Mishnah, continues to say, he used to say, the same Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai that we've been speaking about, he used to say the following, if all the sages of Israel were in one cup of a balance scale, and Eliezer ben Horkinus were in the other, he would outweigh them all. Okay, this is something a modern, a contemporary teacher would never do. But he does, and he tells you, and ultimately, Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkinus, described previously as being the water cistern that never loses a drop, he outweighs the balance of the scale, even if all of the sages were on the other side. However, the Mishnah makes its point of saying, Abba Shaul, on the other hand, said in his name, there's a conflicting report that says, no, that's not what Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai used to say. That's one version of what Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai used to say. The other version is brought by Abba Shaul, and he says, absolutely not. Actually, what Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai used to say was, if all of the sages of Israel were in one cup of a balance scale, Eliezer ben Horkinus included, and Elazar ben Arach were on the other side, he would outweigh them all. So there seems to be the end of the Mishnah, is there are two contenders for the status of being the ultimate rabbinic scholar, the ultimate student of Torah, potentially, or presumably also the ultimate then teacher of Torah, is who? And there are two contenders for the title. One is Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkinus, the water cistern that never loses a drop, and the other is Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, the overflowing fountain. So if I was tempted to spend more time with these two already, I'm even more convinced of it now. That the Mishnah is actually directing me to hold on for a second and think more about, get to know with more intimacy these two men, because they are the contenders for the title. Now, metaphors, as we said before, require us to spend a little bit more time with them. And we don't have much time, but we can't skip the step of unpacking the metaphor for a moment. And very briefly, right, not spending, again, we could spend a lot of time on this, but don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I do want to do it, is to, for a moment, brainstorm with you about these two models. The water cistern, the two images. The water cistern on the one hand, and the spring, the fountain, on the other. And I also want to emphasize, draw your attention to something else. What he uses is a perfect balance between the two metaphors, because in both cases, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai emphasizes that this is not just a water, he's not just a water cistern, but he's a water cistern that never loses a drop. In other words, he emphasizes that he is actually the ultimate water cistern. He's the water cistern in its most intense form. Being a water cistern in the most effective way, okay? He's a bor sud, but that's not enough. He wants to emphasize he never loses a drop, which is what the best type of water cistern actually does. And the same thing is true with the fountain. He doesn't only call him a ma'ayan, but he's a ma'ayan amitgaber. He's an overflowing fountain. Or how is it translated here? An ever-increasing fountain. He's mitgaber. There's something. He's the fountain at its most intense moment of productivity. So in both cases, it's like we take these two different metaphors and we intensify them to their ultimate level. So let's play around with them for a minute. Let's think about these two images, and I'm going to ask you for just a couple of minutes, not yet to transfer into what this might mean when describing a person or a student this way. Let's stay in the realm of the image itself, the metaphor itself. When you think of a water cistern, as opposed to an overflowing fountain, What adjectives, what characteristics come to mind? Let's just start brainstorming. What comes to mind? Here, this as opposed to this.
It's deep in the ground.
Okay, this is deep. Well, which one is deep, actually?
The water cistern.
Okay, this is deep, and this is not deep?
From the deep.
What?
They're both deep.
From the deep. Okay, that's interesting. What do you mean?
It comes from the center of the earth.
Okay, the direction of the water is the water comes from, from below
yes.
out, whereas a water cistern...
You have to go down and collect it.
You have to go down and collect it, and also the source of the water presumably also is external, comes from above, all right? The rain fills the water cistern, and then the water cistern keeps it until you're ready to use it, and then you have to make the effort. Here, the movement is in the opposite direction.
I think you said what passive and active.
Okay. This is passive. This is passive. This is active. What? There's movement. Okay? There's movement here. There's a dynamic here. Whereas here it's static. Here it's static. It doesn't move.
Both of them are pure.
Both of them are pure. Yes. Okay. Interesting. Pure and pure. I was in the middle of writing. What was I writing here? Unmovable or unmoving. Those are two different words, maybe two different concepts. What else?
Maybe a little bit off, but one you could say, because it holds, it can nurture. It's an extension of...
It holds, it nurtures. And yin. This...
This is waste.
This broadcast.
Somebody said something interesting. What?
Waste.
There's something... you know what? I'll put a question mark here, okay? Because we'll maybe be a little bit. But there's something that this overflowing fountain where the waters are gushing forth, not necessarily being channeled to any particular use or any particular. There's just something. There's just all that productivity. But waters are just coming, and it could appear, or I could be concerned. There's something wasteful about this, or potentially wasteful. Whereas this is extremely
conservative.
This is, it's conservative with a lowercase. It's also very efficient, especially because it never loses a drop. It's very efficient. It's also very...
Not sharing. It's really...
It holds on to its... Yeah, but it's there too.
Kind of boring.
You have to pull out.
You have to draw out.
Okay, I'll put boring here, although it'll be interesting when we get to it. Yeah.
Isn't it a closed system? Once the water is in there, it's
closed. It's closed. It contains a finite amount of water.
But the other is a constant renewal.
Okay. That's an important word. It's also very, right, this renewing. It's constantly changing. The water that was there yesterday is not the water that's there today. It's different water all the time. This is the same water, the same amount of water. There's a finite amount of water that it can contain after which it's full, and it can hold on to all, presumably, again, because it's such a fine water cistern, nothing is lost, but also nothing, right, nothing can be. And I know exactly, at any given moment, I presumably know exactly what's there. No surprises. There's a lot of potential for surprise here. Yeah.
I would think the water cistern, the comparison to water cistern is that he's very selfish. He withholds the information. You have to go and draw it out of him, whereas the fountain is willing to share all the Torah that he has.
The fountain just gives and gives and gives and gives, and it's a never-ending...
Whether or not you wanted it, you get it.
Yes. Yes. Whether or not you wanted it, you get it. It can overwhelm. It can maybe perhaps even feel like, I guess it depends what you're imagining, but if you're imagining these little water fountains, you know, the springs that we have here in this country, maybe not so much, but if you think of these geysers, is that how it's pronounced? Geysers? I don't even know how to pronounce it. I grew up in this country. It could be overwhelming. It could also be even maybe a little bit scary, a little bit sad. There's a wildness about it. There's a wildness about it that's not controlled. There's no control here. Nobody controls
it.
It's also, what?
Like a wadi when it floods.
Nahon. There's no control here. This also, and maybe with this we'll begin to wrap up because I do want to move on to our sources. This is also a product of man-made civilization. It is efficient because it's constructed. It's a man-made construct that is there to provide me with what I need when I need it. This belongs out there in the wild, in the natural world. It is not harnessed to any specific task. It's just there. out there, wild and productive and producing and... Okay. Leaving all that on the sid, let's move to see who these two men are. Who are these men? One of whom is described...
Young.
Sorry?
This is a very young teenager. This is a very wild man.
Yeah. You're saying... Okay. We'll see. No, I hear you. I definitely hear you. Look, I think actually maybe we could very... If we think about it, we probably know people who are like this and like this. We might have gone to school with people who have been like this and like this. We might know what it feels like to sit next to them in class. There's this one and this one. We might also have had teachers that have been like this and teachers that have been like that. We might, some of us have had students that have been like this and that have been like that. And we understand intuitively that they're very, very different. They're very different. It's a very different experience to learn from them. It's a very, very different experience to teach them. And therefore, again, with this last, nearly last word, I wanted to say that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who is capable of being a teacher, both of the water cistern that never loses a drop, to give this student what he needs, and to give this student what he needs, and to be the same person, is really quite extraordinary. And the only thing I can say to myself is it's only likely that a person who studied both from Hillel and Shammai might even potentially be able to be the teacher both of this man and of this man. And we will soon see how deeply both men revere this man as their teacher. So he was a significant teacher, giving each one of them precisely what they needed. Okay, let's get to know them. Let's see what it looks like. Now, when it's not a metaphor, it's not an image, it's a person. It's a person studying Torah that is being described by all of this and much more. And what does he look like? Let's start with Rabbi Lazar ben Arach. Okay, here we go. In passing, and really just in passing, I do want to just mention source number 2 is the continuation of the previous source, where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sends his students off with a quest. Mamash, one of these quests, it almost sounds like one of these Zen stories where the master sends you off with a quest, and the quest is go and see which is the best trait for a person to acquire. And they all go off and they come back with the answers. I just want to draw your attention, I put it in bold so we can go directly to Rabbi Lazar ben Arach's answer. The best trait that a person can acquire, Rabbi Lazar ben Arach said, a good heart. And then when he sends on the second quest, go and see which is the worst trait, the one that a person should most distance himself from, he comes back with the same answer, this time, an evil heart. And in both times, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is very, very impressed with his answer. And in both times, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, I prefer the words of Elazar ben Arach to the rest of your answers. His answer is the best. His answer is most inclusive. Now, again, if we had time, we would spend more time on this source. Right now, I want us to just tuck away in our minds the image of the heart that is joining now the image of the overflowing fountain, okay? The heart that pumps, the heart that produces, the heart that's the... That's Rabbi Lazar ben Arach. And if we're talking about portrait painting, I would say that I would expect any portrait of Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, right, not literally, but figuratively, to have somewhere on the canvas a heart. Because the heart is going to be a recurring motif, and we're going to come across it time and again, that in Rabbi Lazar ben Arach's stories, the heart makes an appearance. And it's not coincidental. If we were into heraldry, Jewish rabbinic heraldry, I would say Rabbi Lazar ben Arach's family crest would have a heart on it, because it is very much who he is, and it already makes an appearance here in his introduction in Pirkei Avot. We will find it again. Let's move on. We actually have, with Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, what might be almost a rare opportunity to observe him, that the Talmud shares with us a very, very unique moment where we can actually observe him in action. Let's, open the window of the Beit Midrash of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai and his student Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, and let's watch them study Torah together. Let's watch what it looks like. Let's observe what it might look like when a teacher teaches his student who is an overflowing fountain. Everything that we said before, and again, much more. So we're turning to the Gemara in Masechet Chagiga. Half a word about the context. All right, Masechet Chagiga has a Mishnah. Well, again, I can't go into the larger context, but the very immediate context. The Mishnah teaches in Masechet Chagiga, the Mishnah prescribes the proper format and the proper forum in which various areas of Torah study should be studied. right? It prescribes that certain, this kind of era, this kind of study or studying of this topic must be done in this format. Study of this topic should be done in a different format. And amongst other things, it talks about the studying of an area of study which is referred to as Maaseh Merkava, the work of the chariot. The work of the chariot is a rabbinic term for mysticism, mystical contemplation. And the Mishnah says there quite clearly that mystical contemplation, right, the work of the chariot, it's of course constructed on Ezekiel's image of the chariot, the Maaseh Merkava in the book of Yechezkel, but that activity of studying the work of the chariot must be done, the Mishnah says, only one-on-one, no more than that. One teacher, one student, one-on-one. And only if the student is wise and has self-understanding. The words of the Mishnah are chacham v'mevin midato. Those are the instructions of the Mishnah about the work of the chariot. And in that context of that Mishnah, the Gemara tells us the following story, which gives us the opportunity to watch Rabbi Elazar ben Arach study Torah with his teacher. Let's listen. Our rabbis taught, Tanu Rabbanan. It's presented as a Tannaitic source. Once Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was riding on a donkey when going on a journey, and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach was driving the donkey from behind. Rabbi Elazar said to him, Master, teach me a chapter of the work of the chariot. Okay, I'm going to pause here for a second because the curtain rises and I already told you we're about to get a glimpse into what this looks like. And lo and behold, first and foremost, what I want to draw our attention to is where are we? When we observe Rabbi Elazar ben Arach and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai studying Torah together, when the scene unfolds, where are we? And where are we not? We are not in the city. We're not in a classroom. We're not in a Beit Midrash. We are not sitting in four walls behind a desk with a book open in front of us and a pencil in our hand. By no means. Where are we? We are outside, on a journey, moving. Okay? There's a donkey there. We'll talk about the donkey in just a second. We are outside, on a journey, moving. We're in movement. All right? Now, already here, we can say to ourselves, aha, of course. A water fountain, an overflowing fountain, a person, a student who's cannot be contained within four walls behind a desk with a workbook and an assignment. That's not the way they study. He's outside, in the nature, in the wild, moving, constantly on the move. His teacher knows this about him. And his teacher, real learning takes place between Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach outside, on a journey. Now, we seem to fall into a familiar or at least a conventional mode because the teacher is on the donkey, the student is following from behind. It looks like we're in our conventional sort of teacher-student kind of hierarchy, both visually as well as who's first, who's following. But actually, if you have sharp eyes or sharp ears, or know something, listen carefully also to the way it was presented. What? Rabbi Elazar ben Arach was driving the donkey from behind. Okay? So visually, at first glance, it looks like, oh, of course, right, the teacher's first. But when you look at it more carefully, you recognize that the relationship between the teacher and the student is not the teacher's leading. Who's actually leading? The student is leading. Yes, he's behind, but he's leading the donkey that the teacher is on. All right? So we have all kinds of models here or suggestions that the kind of Torah that's going to unfold in this particular relationship follows a mold that might not necessarily be the conventional mode that we might be used to thinking about when we think about conventional learning, right? And it looks different. He's outside on the donkey, driving the donkey from behind. And what does he want to study? When he approaches his teacher, he says, teach me a chapter of the work of the chariot. That's where my heart, right? I'm inserting the word heart here, but that's where I want to study. What doesn't he ask to study? Kalacha. He doesn't say, please, I desperately, teach me how to make a cup of tea on Shabbat, okay? Or teach me how to choose my etrog and lulav on Sukkot. That's not what he wants to study. He wants to study the work of the chariot. What's the work of the chariot? The contemplation of the infinite, divine, the limitless, uncontained, uncontainable truth of God. That's what he wants to study. Now, again, is that in character? Is that what you would expect an overflowing fountain to want to study? Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't even begin to imagine his soul yearning to be contained, right, in boxes of kos rishon, kos sheni, kos shlishi. That's not what he wants to study. It's contrary to where his heart lies, what he's all about. He wants to study those expanses of the work of the chariot. Now, what does his teacher answer him? Let's continue. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai answers him, "Have I not taught you thus? Nor the work of the chariot in the presence of one, unless he is a sage and understands of his own knowledge." That's a quote from the Mishnah that this story is told in its context. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, "We've been through this already. Come on, you know that the kind of study that you want to do, the kind of study that you do, that you truly do, is only one-on-one and only if you have your own self-understanding." In other words, what is he saying to him?
You're not ready.
I don't think so, actually. I think he is ready, and in a minute we'll see that he's very ready. But what he says to him is, what is this business of teach me? What do you mean teach me a chapter of the work of the chariot? What?
I'm going to suggest that he's doing something else.
He's going
to
say,
Bidiyu.
That's not the way you study the work of the chariot. You can't come to somebody and say, teach me. Teach me is passive. Teach me is this mode. Teach me is what you say when you want to study, maybe Hilchot Shabbat, you say, teach me. Fill me up, okay? Fill me up with your knowledge. If you want to study the work of the chariot, then you got to start all over again. You don't start by approaching your teacher and saying, teach me. The work of the chariot is studied only by people who have self-understanding. Look into yourself. You'll find the work of the chariot there. And I know you. I know who you are. I think he's actually saying the opposite. I think he's the teacher that requires that his student be loyal to who he really is. He's saying, I'm not taking any of that teach me from you. If you were Rabbi Lazar ben Horkin, who's my other student, you said, teach me, of course I would teach you. He wouldn't ask to study the work of the chariot. He would be asking somebody else, of course I would respond. But that's not you. That's not me when I'm with you. When I'm with you, we should be doing, it works differently. It doesn't work in the teach me mode. It works in a different mode. Now, a good teacher can gently redirect their student back to where they should be. Because if you are a Mayan Mitgaber and you want to study Maaseh Merkavah, then readjust. And it looks like he does. Because his response is, Rabbi Lazar then said to him, well then, master, permit me to say before thee something which thou hast taught me. Now that is a very interesting statement. Let me say something to you that you've already taught me. Now that could be many things. It could be, let me just recite back to you what I heard from you last week. In which case, as a teacher, I can say it could be very boring to just hear your own words back at you. But it doesn't, and that doesn't appear that to be what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai understands him to be. But rather, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, immediately after hearing that, he gives him permission to speak, and he does the following. Immediately, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, having given him permission to say something that he taught him, what does he do? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai dismounted from the donkey, wrapped himself up, and sat upon a stone beneath an olive tree. Said Rabbi Lazar to him, master, why did you dismount from the donkey? He answered, is it proper that while you are expounding the work of the chariot, and the divine presence will be with us, and the ministering angels accompany us, I should ride on a donkey? So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knows that when his student adjusts into the proper mode and asks for permission, let me speak. Let me tell you something that you've taught me. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai prepares himself for anything. Anything can happen. Anything and everything can happen. Because I'm not just going to hear the words that I said last week back at me. I know that I'm going to hear something new, exciting, dramatic. And I get off the donkey. I get off the donkey because I know my student. And I know that his words are going to be earth-shaking, literally, as we'll soon read.
When it says he wrapped himself, does that mean he puts tefillin on?
I don't think so. It says if you look, nitatef, I think you usually doesn't, the nitatef, I think the passive doesn't imply his tefillin. I think it implies some kind of wrapping up in a cloak. But it's an interesting element. Let's think about that for a second. What is he doing? He gets off the donkey, he wraps himself up, and he sits on a stone. What does it sound like he's doing?
He's getting ready to be there for a while. Like, he's getting comfortable.
Okay, possibly. Okay, this is who knows how long this can take? Okay, what else?
He's protecting himself and angering himself.
I think there's a bit of a sense of protection. Okay, anything can happen, anything and everything can happen, and I need a little bit of, and that anchoring and that stone under the tree, I hear it, definitely. There was a practice to wear tefillin all day,
but... when you're in a donkey, you probably take it off.
Nitatef is not usually the verb that's used to describe the wrapping in tefillin.
He may not be able to concentrate as much when he's riding on a donkey. Mm-hmm. He sits on a place...
Okay, this is not going to be boring.
Yeah.
This is going to require focus, and this is going to require maybe protection and maybe grounding, because this is going to zoom. Remember the arrow going up here? Okay, this is... Anything can happen now when my student takes off. Okay, let's see what happens. Immediately, Rabbi Lazar ben Arach began his exposition of the work of the chariot. And fire came down from heaven and encompassed all the trees of the field. Thereupon they all began to utter divine song. The trees. What was the song they uttered? Quote, praise the Lord from the earth, you sea monsters and all deeps, fruitful trees and all cedars. Hallelujah. Ken hallelujah Hashem min ha'aretz, taninim v'chol tehomot, etz pri v'chol arazim. Hallelujah. I'd put it to music if I could. If I had the talent, I would. Right? The world is bursting into song. The trees are bursting into song. Fire comes from heaven. All of this in response to Rabbi Lazar ben Arach's teaching, that which he presents as having learned from his teacher, but it's happening in real time now, and it's alive, and it's. And it's overwhelming, and it's dynamic, and it's moving, and it's...
I was just going to ask you, what sense was this, what he learned from his teacher?
I don't know, but he certainly is identifying it as becoming from his teacher, and his teacher perhaps potentially is also confirming that I understand that this is coming from me in some way and somehow, at least that you experience it, but I also understand that what I'm hearing back is not what I put in. It's not like the water system where you put in water and you get back the same water you put in last week. That's what you find next week. This is different. You claim that the water that's being produced here is coming from me. I accept that, or I recognize the truth of that, although it's true in ways that are not, that it's differently than this side of the board. It's different. Whatever it is, it's different. I'm not sure I can actually even describe it. It's challenging. It challenges our ideas of learning and teaching. It certainly challenges our ideas of learning and teaching tradition. What happens to a tradition when it's transmitted from a teacher to a student, and when the student repeats the tradition, it's almost unrecognizable, but it is extremely alive and powerful. Right? And now, in a minute, we'll continue, because the entire world is bursting into divine song, the narrator tells us. And maybe now the climactic moment of them all. An angel, the narrator tells us. An angel then answered from the fire. Na'ana malach min ha'esh ve'amar, this is the very work of the chariot. Hen ma'aseh merkava. The narrator insists on inserting here a divine, what is this? It's a divine confirmation that what Rabbi Lazar ben Arach is doing is the real thing. It's genuine. It's authentic. That's divinely confirmed. Who else has a divine confirmation that what they're doing is real? It's the real thing. It's really Torah what you're doing. It's a different type of Torah. It's an exciting type of Torah. It might be a little bit scary type of Torah, but it's real. And the narrator who's narrating us, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, I think for me this is the most important moment, because the artist who's painting the picture wants us to know that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is real. It's the real thing what he's doing. He's not some magician or some What he's doing is real. It's authentic. It's real Torah. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai also recognizes that. Thereupon, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai rose and kissed him on his head and said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who's given a son to Abraham our father, who knows how to speculate upon and to investigate and to expound the work of the chariot. There are some who preach well but do not act well. Others act well but do not preach well. You act well and preach well. Happy art thou, O Abraham, our father, that Rabbi Lazar ben Arach has come forth from thy loins." It ends with a very interesting identification between Rabbi Lazar ben Arach and a biblical character. Who? Avraham Avinu. And here, too, I think, if we're putting together Rabbi Lazar ben Arach's heraldry, I would have a heart, I said, I would have a fountain, and I would have a reference to Avraham Avinu. Now, it's an interesting link between specifically this rabbinic character and the biblical character of Avraham. And what we'll see consistently over the course of the next few classes is that different rabbinic figures seem to be linked to different biblical characters. And Rabbi Lazar ben Arach's biblical image is Avraham. Now, let's think for a minute. What links Avraham with Rabbi Lazar ben Arach?
What? They're both breaking new ground.
They both break new grounds, okay? They both go where no one has gone before. Avraham is the first, right? Avraham produces this whole, with no teacher, right? He produces it from within. What else do we know about Avraham? He's associated most, what comes to mind when you think, what?
Giving.
That givingness, that generosity, that outpouring of giving and giving and giving. What else?
Brings down fire from the heavens.
Manyin. Okay, the imagery of the fire. My initial association with Avraham is, of course, the imperative Lech Lecha. Avraham is also a wanderer. Avraham does not stand still. Avraham is continuously on a journey. So is Elazar ben Arach. The Rambam suggests, I'm going to do this very briefly, but the Rambam also suggests in the first chapter of the Laws of Idolatry, if you're unfamiliar with this text, it's a text that's worthwhile seeing. The Rambam claims also there in a very interesting treatise that he writes that Avraham is also the model, listen carefully, of faith that's channeled not through law. He is the pre-Sinai model of a brit, a covenant with God, that is not channeled through the channel of Torah mitzvot, of commandment. Avraham has a relationship with God that is forged in some other way. And I think what we're beginning to sense is that Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, in his Torah, the Torah that he teaches, studies, the Torah that he lives, is not, again, also not necessarily this mechanism of channeling things through, right, the categories of halakha and the regulations of halakha and the conventions of halakha, but some alternative model of Torah that is breaks through all of that and is just so creative and so uncontrolled that it accesses a different kind of a... He talks about preaching well and doing well, which to some of our ears, I think the more conventional amongst... Oh, I don't want to say that. I know for me, I'll talk about myself. When I first read the story of Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, I will already say I was blown away. I can't come from a traditional conservative with a lowercase c, you know, understanding of Torah and mitzvot. When I first saw this model, this rabbinic model that seems to be offering an alternative idea that Torah is not only about boxes but could be a bursting through of, I actually was totally surprised at his existence and at his position within the pantheon of rabbinic figures. And this idea of Na'e Doresh V'Na'e Mekayem was a huge challenge, rocked me totally, because Na'e Doresh Na'e Mekayem, I think from your ordinary conventional rabbinic perspective, you ordinarily think about Mekayem. When you think about being Mekayem the Torah, what do you think about? Mitzvot. Observing the mitzvot. That's how people, how do you Mekayem the Torah? You observe mitzvot. Now, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says to him, you, na'e doresh v'na'e mekayem, where did we see any na'e mekayem in this story? There's no na'e mekayem, unless we entertain for a moment the possibility that there might be another meaning to being mekayem et haTorah. Maybe to being mekayem et haTorah is to give existence to the Torah, to give life to the Torah, is precisely what we just read. Where you can make this fire come from heaven and the trees sing and the angels sing. Maybe that's an alternative definition of what it is to be mekayem et haTorah. That's a Rabbi Elazar ben Arach option. That's a Mayan Midgaber option. This is what the world of Torah looks like, could look like, if it was channeled through a Mayan Midgaber. It's an alternative universe to...
Perhaps Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is simply more prosaically saying, I know you observe the Torah, and therefore you act well, but now you're showing me that you preach well as well. I mean, in other words, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai would not himself condone somebody who was not Mekayem HaTorah in a conventional sense, would he? I don't know.
Okay, I'm not risking...
But
within the confines of the story. Story is a self-contained unit. And within the confines of that story, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says to him, you are na'e doresh, na'e mekayem. I've just seen it. I'm describing you that way. Now, again, I'm not necessarily suggesting here that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach didn't observe the mitzvot. I mean, I'm not going there. I'm saying for a minute, I think what I'm feeling is we're getting a glimpse into an alternative model of Torah study, of a relationship between a teacher and a student that breaks the conventions, breaks my ordinary conventions of transmitting a tradition and receiving a tradition and maintaining a tradition, which I think my perception of tends to be more on this side of the board. For a minute, the narrator here, the artistry of this man, is for a minute he forces me to rethink. Rethink my definitions. Rethink the experience.
It's a question of the Bishvil Mahatorah. No. Like, this is like an insight into this is what the Torah can bring. This is what this kind of study can do.
Okay.
The Maseh Merkavah is all an aspect of bringing Tikkun Olam Baruch Shalem.
Okay.
So if we're doing that, then wow, this guy is the one who's going to bring it.
Okay. And he can do that in ways because of his... He can do that in ways. Okay. Now the big question is, the huge question...
About the association with Abraham.
Yes.
Abraham, at the in the story of the Akedah, the Akedah described with the test. So here's where Abraham was tested, and at the end of the test, a malach comes and says, yes, you passed the test. And here also, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai challenges him at the beginning, and at the end, a malach comes and says, yes, you passed the test. And then he gets the same from the Malach and from Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai also says, you passed the test.
But the nature of the test, the success, the nature of the test is appropriate to Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. And he does what he's tested and found to be successful in a particular kind of testing, right? And he's tested appropriately. What he demonstrates, what he can do, is once again that which he does, which is again just a little bit off what we ordinarily conventionally associate with traditional rabbinic activity. Right? He's not showing, demonstrating his proficiency in what we usually associate with Talmudic rabbinic activity. Okay, he's doing something else. He's doing something else, and he's doing it successful.
The thing that's kind of bugging me about him and this idea is that it doesn't seem like something that's accessible to most people.
No.
And that I'm thinking if I knew someone who not only... Sure, I know a lot of very big personalities who are overflowing, but if I knew someone who was so mystical and spiritual and holy that they could literally or figuratively make the trees sing, I don't feel like that would be someone who I could relate to in any way.
You'll also notice that there's no one else in this story. They are alone. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is alone with his teacher. There's no one else. There are angels and trees and fire and God and what? There's no one else. which I think is a significant point. And you're actually leading us forward, and I appreciate that because our time is running short. And we want to move to the end of the story. And what we will see continuously is as these portraits are painted and as these stories are told, these biographies, these literary biographies are narrated, a very, very significant point in every narrative is going to be what ends up happening with this person. Where does their destiny lead them? Where does their story lead them? Because their end is ultimately the narrative's final judgment, if you wish, on where this all leads to. Where does this lead to? And there are a number of narratives that talk about what happened to Rabbi Elazar ben Arach and how this such promising, right? This exciting, this creative and productive individual must have, where did all this, where did it, what mark did he leave on rabbinic and Talmudic Judaism? And here, this isn't a spoiler because possibly some of the people sitting in this room already know that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, come to think of it, how often have I come across his name? In Mishnah, in Talmud, in Midrash? Practically not at all. Probably in all the list of the names of people we're going to cover over the next, you recognized all of them, maybe you didn't even recognize his name because he is so absent from rabbinic literature that it's astonishing, especially given this preface. He's an overflowing fountain, ever increasing, always producing, never sitting still. He can produce, right, the divine song, he can bring the world to life. Where did it all go? Why did he not leave his mark on rabbinic Talmudic Judaism in the literature? How come we have none of his Torah? It's gone. Where is it? And there's there are a number of texts within rabbinic literature that talk about where did Rabbi Elazar ben Arach go. We're going to see one of them very briefly, and then we'll take, we have about 15 minutes left, I think, Nachman. I want to spend most of my time with the answer that the Talmud Bavli gives to that question. I'm most intrigued by the Talmud Bavli's answer to where did Rabbi Elazar ben Arach go. But we first want to show you, I first want to read together with you, source number 4, a very brief response, or very brief explanation of what happened to Rabbi Elazar ben Arach and why he left no mark, or little mark, on rabbinic texts. When they left his presence here in the context is that we're reading Avot Rabbi Natan, which is a more or less contemporary to the Talmud work, which is a commentary to chapters of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot. It's more or less it's a text that's compiled more or less parallel to the Talmud, of commentary, as it were, to Pirkei Avot. Avot Rabbi Natan. When they left his presence, his being Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, when the students left his presence, he said, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, I will go to Diomsit, a beautiful place of beautiful water. And they said, we will go to Yavne, a place of many scholars who love the Torah. Okay, comes a moment in time where a choice is made. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach goes to Diomsit, a place of beautiful water, a beautiful place of beautiful water. Once again, we might say to ourselves, naturally, right? He's a water fountain. He's a water spring. Of course he's attracted to a place of beautiful waters. They said, we'll go to Yavne. That's where the Torah, that's where the scholars are. That's where we're going. They being, right, all the other students. Now, here's the final word. He who went to Diomsit, a beautiful place, a beautiful water, his name was decreased in Torah. Nitma'et shmo batorah. They who went to Yavne, a place of many scholars who love the Torah, their name was made great in the Torah. Nitgadel shmam batorah. Now, I think there's a bit of an ambiguity to this text. I think it could be understood at least minimally in two ways, probably more. One possibility is, what is this text saying? Why did Rabbi Elazar ben Arach not leave his mark on the Torah, the Talmud, on the rabbinic, on our rabbinic texts?
Because he was alone.
Okay.
Because
he went off on his own.
And that ties into the study of the mystical.
Okay. Now, he went off on his own, blazing his own path, possibly, into these places of beauty and beautiful waters. But he went off on his own. And people who go off on their own, now here's where we could take one of two possible paths. One possible interpretation, which we will see echoed coming up very soon in the Talmud Bavli. One is, when you go off on your own, your wisdom will ultimately decrease, okay? Your Torah will decrease, because how much can people keep advancing when they're all by themselves? You require a community of scholars to continue to grow in the Torah. They who went to the community of scholars, to Yavne, they grew in the Torah. Their names grew with their wisdom. He went off on his own, and slowly but surely he weakened and dwindled away. That would be one possible interpretation. I think there's another. Want to suggest?
Well, your portrait gallery, he got the smaller, a very small
because
portrait. Because he wasn't mainstream. He wasn't mainstream. He went off to his own family.
In other words, if you're not where the books are being written, all right, if you're not sitting present where the texts are being written, you're off in Diom Sen somewhere. Now, it could be, contrary to the first interpretation, it could be that you are just getting stronger and stronger and greater and doing more and more wonderful things, and the skies are, the fire is still coming down from the heavens, and the trees are still singing, and the divine voice is still coming out and pronouncing that your Torah is great Torah and your Maaseh Merkavah is real, but nobody knows about it. Nobody can know about it. So of course it's not recorded, because if you're not sitting where the history is being written, then you won't be written into history. And then mitma'et shumo batorah is not a reference to his wisdom or to his Torah. It's a reference to his presence or his recording or his impact on the Torah. You can't impact Torah if you're off in Diyum Set. And if you're off doing your individual, creative, inspired and inspiring Torah, but nobody's there to know about it, or even if somebody physically was there, nobody would even be able to understand what you were doing. The angels can understand it. The trees can respond. People can understand what in heaven's name are you all about? I can't. There's no way to hold on to that. So it could be majestic. It could be wonderful. It could be splendor itself, but it's gone. Once you're gone, it's gone. There's no way to transmit that. There's no way to pass that on. Let's read.
No, I'm just thinking of the image of water. You can drown in water. Water is chaos.
Yes.
It's unformed.
Yes.
It's not defined. You can get lost.
Nachon. And that leads us directly into the next text. Okay.
Is this my imagination? This seems to be sort of like implying in a sideways kind of way that he founded a stream, a tradition that wasn't fully accepted by the rabbinic mainstream.
I don't know if we're saying are we saying Nitma'et Shmo in our Torah?
Yeah.
Yes.
But there is this Rabbi Lazal ben Arach Torah out there. That's just not part of our tradition.
That's what it seems. That's what I got from it.
It could be. It could be. Although, you know, to think about it, I think maybe you might be saying the Rabbi Lazar ben Arach. The Rabbi Lazar ben Arach mode maybe still does accompany Judaism. Or Jewish tradition, and on occasion make reappearances over time in different generations and different times. All of a sudden, that Rabbi Lazar ben Arach impulse appears again, but continuous. So I don't know whether it's an alternative tradition, how alternative a tradition it is, how much it has a following.
Nonconformity isn't encouraged.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
I was going to say that he wasn't subject to peer evaluation, which I think makes Torah either accepted or not accepted. It all has to be subject to peer evaluation, and he went off on his own.
Okay.
And he wasn't subject to that.
Okay, but we can also recognize that he can't be subject to that. I mean, it would be so counter to who he was. What do you mean peer evaluation for a Mayan Midgaber? How could you hold him back? How could you contain him?
Unless there's more than you've given us here, we don't know what it is. I mean, it's described in very adjectival terms.
Yeah.
But we don't actually know what it is and what he said, unless it reappears in the Kabbalah, in the teaching of Kabbalah generations on. I mean, that may be an idea.
Not directly. I mean, as far as I know, there's no Kabbalistic
work that ascribes itself to the authorship of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach.
We don't know what it is. Other than it created fireworks.
Okay, that's precisely.
We don't know what it was.
We don't know what it was. Maybe it's not even articulatable. There's no such word. But maybe it can be articulated. Whatever it was, but I still want to insist that whatever it was, the narrator wants to be sure that we recognize that what it was real. And it was genuine, and it was confirmed by God himself, by heaven himself, to have been the authentic thing. We can't dismiss Rabbi Elazar ben Arach as being a crackpot, all right? Or even just being just a nonconformist who's off on his own trip somewhere. He's doing something that has divine confirmation as being real, and the narrator is not letting us off the hook to dismiss him that simply, okay? I don't know what it is, but it was real. It was real. Okay, we have to see very quickly. I won't let you go home before seeing this. The Talmud Bavli in Masechet Shabbat raises the same question, what happened to Rabbi Elazar ben Arach? And gives us, I think, a much richer answer than the one we previously read in the Avot to Rabbi Natan. And here's the narrative. The context is, we're in Masechet Shabbat, the context of the Gemara is discussing whether it's permissible to immerse oneself in hot springs on Shabbat. Okay? Won't go into, of course, the halachic problems here, but it's questioning, can one immerse oneself in natural hot springs on Shabbat? In that context, it mentions the name of a place actually that we've just heard about, Diom Set. Diom Set is mentioned by the Talmud as being one of the presumably most popular spa towns right in the area. It presumably, in a minute we'll see, doesn't seem to be in Eretz Yisrael itself. It seems to be maybe possibly across the Jordan, a little bit distant, but it seems to have been a place of well-known hot springs where people would go to bathe and whatever. And in the context of mentioning Diom Set, the Gemara brings the following statement. Rabbi Chelbo said it was the wine of Prugaita and the water of Diom Set that cut off the 10 tribes from Israel. Okay, the legend, or not legend, right, the fact, the truth, whatever, of the 10 tribes of Israel who were exiled in the first exile and never came back. And Rabbi Chelbo is addressing the question, why didn't they come back? What led them astray? Why did they get lost? How did the 10 lost tribes become the 10 lost tribes? And his answer is simple. It's the wine of Prugaita and the waters of Diom Set cut them off, caused them to lose their way back. And in that context, and keep that in mind, the Gemara then relates the following narrative. Now, this is a Bavli exclusive. This doesn't appear in any other rabbinic text. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach visited that place. There's a little bit of a difference between the English translation and the Hebrew Aramaic original that I want to emphasize. In the Aramaic, it's Ikla Lehatam. He chanced upon that place. He came upon that place, not visited that place. The reason I'm emphasizing it is because I think the intentionality that visiting that place is not in the original. And therefore, I'm back to Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, the wanderer. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach journeys and wanders. He most definitely does not have a destination in mind necessarily when he goes off on his journey. He journeys because that's who he is. He's continuously exploring and moving and discovering, and that's changing. That's who he is.
But Rabbi Natan said early on, I will go to the
Let's focus on the narrative of the Bavli. The narrative of the Bavli is not necessarily committed to the Avot de Rabbi Natan. Okay. You're right. And the Avot de Rabbi Natan makes him less of a wanderer. But if we start anew, it's a different portrait. We have two portraits hanging on the wall, okay? One portrait picture, this portrait, the Talmud Bavli's portrait, has him wandering not necessarily with specific destinations in mind, and he happens upon a lot of places. Amongst others, he happened upon Diom Set. It's a very different, I agree with you, thank you for pointing that out. It's a different portrait, it's a different image with different nuances, different emphasis. He comes to Diom Set. He was attracted to them. Imshich batraihu. He was drawn after them. Who's them?
The waters.
And the wines. Now the waters and the wines are drawing Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. And once again I'm asking myself, is that in character? Of course, why? Because what are wines and waters?
Liquids.
Yes, but more than liquids.
Wine is intoxicating.
Yes, and so are hot mineral springs. We're talking not just about water, we're talking about mineral springs. Hot mineral springs, they have an effect on one's consciousness, right? There are all those warning signs, right? Don't stay in more than 15 minutes. They affect the body, they affect your... They're intoxicants. They're mind-altering substances, okay? Now, would Rabbi Elazar ben Arach be drawn to that kind of experience? Absolutely. Because what he's all about is absolute freedom. What he's all about is absolute release from all constraints. What he's all about is that breaking through anything that holds me back, anything that confines me, anything is stifling, is not is an anathema, is that the right word? For an overflowing fountain. I constantly am looking for lehefech, I'm looking for space. I'm not looking for I'm anything that can free me from things that are holding me back is what I need, what I'm looking for. So he's drawn after these wives. Now I know I'm painting a picture here that's beginning to me it sounds a little familiar, okay? He's off on this right, experimenting with all kinds of mind-altering substances, but it's part of who he is. He's part of what he does. He was attracted to them, and the Talmud Bavli says his learning vanished. Now, the original here, this is why you can't use a translation. The original says, E'akar Talmudei. His learning was uprooted. Now, that could mean it would vanished, right? When you uproot something, it's like you're destroying it. But on the other hand, I think to myself, wow, the image of being uprooted also means I'm being freed. Right? The roots are what are holding me back. When you uproot something, it also could be, depending on your perspective. Now, a very conventional perspective would be to say, you just destroyed it, right? Uprooting it is tearing it out. You just killed it. But someone else might say, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, for instance, if we heard his version, he would say, don't feel sorry for me. Don't feel sorry. I freed myself. You have no idea. I've just ultimately made that last. I freed myself. I'm free. 5 more minutes. When he came back, when he returned. Now here already is my first inclination, especially coming on the tail end of the 10 lost tribes. He came back. If he came back, then he didn't become the 10 lost tribes. There's still something there. Which is why that vanishing, that iakar, my senses, maybe it's not as destructive as it might appear. He comes back. And here's the great dramatic moment. He gets up to read from the Torah. I like to imagine this, of course, is his first Shabbat back after this long journey away. He's been away for who knows what. And of course he gets an aliyah when he goes back to shul. Like, nahon, bidiyuk. He gets up to read from the Torah. He wished to read. The Aramaic is be'ah lemikra. Be'ah is an Aramaic verb that can mean he wished. But it can also mean he should have. He was required. Right? It could mean haya tzarich. Haya rotzeh. So this could be something that he wanted to do, or it could be something that he was required to do. He should have read. Ha'chodesh hazeh lachem. Here's the parsha that he was supposed to read. The section that he was supposed to read is Shemot, right? Chapter 12, HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem. And instead he reads, HaChiresh Haya Libam. He totally, miserably misreads the whole pasuk, okay? HaChodesh, whoops, HaZeh Lachem. Sorry. He misreads as HaChiresh Haya Libam. He mistakes the Dalet for a Resh and the Zayin for a Yud. And he mistakes the Kaf for a Bet. Mistakes, by the way, I won't ask people to confess here, but some of us might have made on occasion, especially if we're reading, think about reading Rashi script, right? How many times it happens to you when you read Rashi script. So here it is, like a dramatic moment. The great Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, the student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the one who was a contender for the position of outweighing everyone else, can't even read a pasuk. Look what's happened to him. His learning has vanished to the point where he can't even read. So on the one hand, that's what it sounds like the narrator is telling us. But on the other hand, the mistake is so dramatic that it can't be a mistake. Or we wonder, is this a mistake? What is he doing? He's rereading the pasuk. And it has meaning. Ha-chodesh hazeh lachem turns into ha-chiresh haya libam. Ma zeh ha-chiresh haya libam? Are their hearts, watch the heart, nahon? Are their hearts deaf? Their hearts are deaf, he says. Instead of reading, this month is unto you a month of the first of all months, he reads, your hearts are deaf. I'm going to suggest very briefly, because our time is running out, so I'm going to suggest that what Rabbi Lazar ben Arach is doing here is once again doing what he does. He's breaking conventions. He's breaking free. And he's saying, I don't have to read it in any particular way, or the possibilities of reading the Torah are infinite. Infinite. Do we have infinite on the board? They're infinite. And you don't have to confine yourself to only a specific reading of the Torah, and especially not the kind of specific reading of the Torah that you all confine yourselves to, he says, speaking to his community. HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem is what? It's regulating the calendar. It's setting the rhythm for which we live our lives. It's also the first mitzvah of the Torah. And he says to them, all you read, when you read Torah, all you read is regulations, regulations, mitzvot, mitzvot, convention, convention, containers, containers. That's how you guys read Torah. Well, I'm back from my journey to tell you that you're deaf. Your hearts are deaf. There's so much more out there that you don't even imagine, that you don't allow yourselves to see because you're so contained into your little boxes. And I'm breaking free, and I'm breaking free even of the conventions of language. Dalets can be reshes, and zines can be yuds, and kafs can be bits, and I can do freedom, because freedom will allow access to levels of spirituality that you have no inkling that even exist, and I'm here to tell you that they exist. I'm here to call you to open your hearts. Do they hear him?
No.
They pray for his rehabilitation.
Absolutely.
They say to themselves, he's lost it. He needs to be brought back into the fold, okay? You can't break conventions to this point of breaking down the meanings of words and the meanings of letters if you do that. If you do that, we're all scattered maybe in this burst of glory, but we're how can we maintain any kind of communication? We can't communicate if you're going to break conventions to this point. We need you back with us here, and you need to rejoin the community. You have to accept some conventions. You can't take this to its ultimate end. If you take this model to its ultimate end, you have two possibilities. Either you break free, and we watch you rise up to the heavens, you know, just possibly we can wave goodbye. That's all we can do. But if you want to keep eye contact with us, if you want students, if you want us to follow you, you have to give up some of your overflowing fountainness. And in order to do so, that's what you have to do. And Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, presumably, well, at least according to the narrative, you can see it yourself, according to some versions, accepts the price. And he restricts himself, and he comes back to the fold, and he becomes Rabbi Nehorai. He changes his name. And he leaves behind some of his fountainness, precisely so that he can maintain contact with us. But the Elazar ben Arach, the original, is lost to us. He's lost, but he's not lost. And with this I conclude. Because his portrait still hangs in our portrait gallery. And that is the most exciting, for me personally, was the most exciting discovery of them all. That rabbinic Judaism, in spite of, as you said before, not tolerating non-conventional, what was it you said?
Non-conformative.
And it's true. There's a statement about what Rabbi Lazar ben Arach represents. The breaking of convention, that non-conformism has a terrible price and we're not willing to pay it. However, we do keep Rabbi Lazar ben Arach's portrait hanging in our portrait gallery. And as we walk into the Beit Midrash, I think I kind of like to imagine the rabbis of the Beit Midrash looking up on occasion at Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, the old Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, the original Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, the overflowing fountain Rabbi Lazar ben Arach. And occasionally they'll look up on their shoulders and they'll say, what would he think of what we're doing now? And somehow his presence is going to impact the rabbinic world, even though we're rejecting him as the ultimate model for Torah study. His presence is still maintained on the walls of the portrait gallery, affecting us to a certain extent, possibly, hopefully, maybe even to this very day.
Yeah, and just to underline that, the last sentence, he continues to enlighten the eyes of the sages.
In halacha.
In halacha.
In halacha. We take him with us on our journey, which is not his journey or different journey, but we take him with us, and somehow his, I think so. And for me, again, it's coming from a very conventional perception of rabbinic, this was a discovery, that he exists. That he exists and he's on our portrait, he's on our walls, Ken. Okay, well, thank you very much. And those of you